You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Suzanne Finstad is my guest. She's the author of several biographies, including Child Bride, The Untold Story of Priscilla Presley, Warren Beatty, A Private Man, and 20 years ago, her classic bestseller, Natasha, the biography of Natalie Wood. Now, Suzanne Finstad is revisiting Natasha with a new volume called Natalie Wood, The Complete Biography. Suzanne Finstad, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So do you feel that in the current atmosphere, the Me Too era, that the stories that you've been telling, Natalie Wood, as well as Priscilla Presley and Warren Beatty, should be viewed in a new way?
Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about sort of aggregating all three of them. I know definitively that Natalie Wood should. There was actually a piece that came out about the book a couple of weeks ago, and the title of the piece was Natalie Wood, the Original Me Too Girl. So I think that kind of says it all. I don't know if people who haven't read Natasha or haven't read the new book understand where that's coming from, but she had experiences in her child star days and in her ingenue days that are so parallel to what has been happening today with the Me Too movement and, of course, most egregiously with the conviction of Harvey Weinstein. She had her own sort of Weinstein-esque experiences and paved the way in a tragic way for what's happened with other actresses. So this is nothing new, and she endured this without the support of the media, without any kind of social consciousness surrounding this. It was something that was just accepted in her day, and in fact, she was too terrified to tell anyone or to report this, which, of course, is what happened with many of the victims in hashtag Me Too until this became such a public movement.
But you sort of have to look at Priscilla Presley in a similar way. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
Elvis Wood, Priscilla, when she was about... How old was Priscilla when Elvis...
Priscilla was 14, and you're really astute, actually, to bring that up, Gary. That's what drew me to write Child Bride. I had always been intrigued. I mean, everyone loved Elvis Presley. His music is astounding and speaks for itself. But part of the story that always confounded me and troubled me was this kind of unexplored aspect of his relationship as an adult superstar with a 14-year-old girl in Germany. And the only book that had been written about that was her memoir. And I just assumed that what was in her memoir was truthful until I started to write my biography and I saw that there had been this kind of spin put on it, and I honestly believe that Priscilla believes these things herself. I think that, as happens with so many people who are victims of this kind of abuse, you sort of create a fictional scenario to try to make it palatable. But she was 14 years old, and he was in his 20s, and there's nothing appropriate about that.
Well, even in Priscilla's memoir, she does say that Elvis lost interest in her once she became a mother.
Yeah, yeah. Now, and I write about that at great length. He had a lot of hang-ups, and my sort of psychological take on Elvis Presley is that he was someone who was emotionally stunted, having become a star at a young age, who really never had a chance to develop in terms of his puberty and youth and sort of dating in a normal way, and by virtue of his stardom, he was able to attract any female he wanted, and no one questioned the age of that female. And I think that emotionally he felt more comfortable with young girls. Not that that in any way excuses it, but I think that's the level that he was at, sort of emotionally. And this kind of went on behind closed doors, and literally at Graceland it went on behind the gates of that mansion when he moved her in when she was in high school. You know, Gary, that never ceases to astonish me, that this was happening, that he had a teenage girl who was living there, and that he was able to sort of I guess, pulled that off. She was attending a Catholic girls' school, and no one really questioned it. There seemed to be a kind of, I guess, what they used to call a gentleman's agreement with the press, as happened with, for example, John F. Kennedy and his affairs. There are just certain public figures where, I guess, the press looks the other way to the detriment of, in this case, what was happening with a young girl.
Well, I guess her parents, you know, they obviously said, okay, oh, yeah, sure, go ahead.
I know. That's the tragedy within a tragedy. I could tell you really zeroed in on all of the right things in that book, and the reason that I found the story so compelling. And that, again, is what interested me in exploring that topic, is how could her parents permit this? And what I found to my astonishment is that more than permitting it, they encouraged it. And there was a certain point where Priscilla had lost interest in Elvis after she began dating him, and she was really happier with the appropriate high school boys that she was dating in Germany. And I sort of liken it to this runaway train where, you know, she's dating this superstar and her parents are giddy with excitement over this. And, you know, she sort of got caught up in other people's dreams and fantasies and what I think she called it Elvis stardust.
It's kind of incredible, isn't it? You know, and I'm sure this, the thing is, you know, the stories that you write are about people who are famous, and therefore their lives have been well covered. But I suppose these kinds of relationships happen all the time. We just don't know about them as much.
Yeah, we don't. And I think that they go on far more than we realize. And I think that the light is now starting to shine on them in a way that exposes the incorrectness, the immorality, and the inhumanity of what's going on. But again, with celebrities, it's pardoned, it's somehow excused, which, you know, I think there's a parallel too, Gary, to what happens in the case of Natalie Wood's death, where part of the reason, probably the majority of the reasons, that the investigation of her death was non-existent the first time around is because of this kind of celebrity privilege. The notion that she was married to a very famous television star, and the investigator who was investigating the case was completely starstruck, and he just got a pass because it was Robert Wagner. It's just a real injustice.
And I definitely want to get into that with you in a short while. But one of the things that was related to that was Frank Sinatra. So in your new book, you talk a lot about Frank Sinatra having influenced the investigation. But you also basically call Frank Sinatra a pedophile.
Well, I guess I don't know if I use that word. That's the innuendo, because those are the facts. You know, he was at the time, he was middle-aged, and Natalie Wood was 15 years old, and she'd been dating a high school boy. She was in love with this high school boy. He'd even asked her to marry her. And Natalie's mother, who, as I alluded to just a bit ago, was a stage mother, Machiavellian stage mother, beyond anything in Natalie's movie Gypsy. She really is deserving of being in the Hall of Fame of stage mothers in an evil way. And she did not want Natalie to marry this boy from high school. She felt that it would destroy her career or end her career. And for Natalie's mother, it was all about Natalie Wood's career. She was living through her daughter, as so many bad stage mothers do. And she ended the relationship between Natalie and her high school boyfriend in a really dramatic, awful way. And she wanted Natalie to then take up with Frank Sinatra. And she managed to meet Frank Sinatra, I think, at a commissary at one of the studios, and sort of ingratiated herself to him and got Natalie invited over to Frank Sinatra's house for cocktails, even though Natalie was 15. And her mother drove her there, and then her mother left shortly thereafter. And Natalie and Frank continued to meet for what Frank's valet, live-in valet, said were being called music lessons. And, you know, I was told by a co-star of Natalie's at the time, she was in television series, and they were playing brother-sister and were very, very, very close friends. They'd known each other as child stars in Miracle on 34th Street and continued to remain friends through life, very much like siblings. And Natalie would tell him when she would come back to the set what was going on with Frank Sinatra and how her mother had wanted her to lose her virginity to a big star because it would be better for Natalie's career. And, you know, I can't say for certain what happened when she and he went into his bedroom, but the valet wrote a book a couple of years back, and he witnessed this, and he witnessed what Natalie told her friend Robert Hyatt, and said that, you know, Frank took her back into the bedroom, and, you know, he was frankly more graphic about that in describing how Frank didn't want him to be witness to a crime. So, you know, I think you can draw your own conclusions about what happened. I do know that Frank Sinatra, it was not a purely prurient relationship by any means. He actually, in that Sinatra kind of way, such a complicated character, he genuinely loved Natalie and had a sort of avuncular or fatherly relationship with her, which I know sounds very creepy in light of this, but they continued to have, I guess, what you would call a kind of friends with benefits relationship for many, many years after that. And he continued to look after her in almost a godfather way. And that extended to her younger sister, Lana, who told me that when she went on her first trip to Europe, that Frank had even hired some, I think he called them goons, to follow her when she was on this trip in Europe to make sure that she was safe. And Henry Jaglom, who dated Natalie in the mid-60s, said that Frank Sinatra would come to Natalie's house when Natalie was preparing to go out with Henry, and that Sinatra did not approve of him as a suitor for Natalie, and that when Henry and Natalie went on their date, that he looked behind the car, and Sinatra had hired some friend or PI or someone to trail them to make sure that nothing happened to Natalie. So it's a complicated relationship for sure. And again, I think that you hit it when you asked me initially about hashtag Me Too and about these, you know, really inappropriate relationships. And people just look the other way, or they presume that it was normal or part of show business. And, you know, young women and women in general were just not being protected.
And of course, in the movies, you often saw actors like, you know, Frank Sinatra or Fred Astaire. As the older Fred Astaire got, the younger his co-stars got. That was a very common thing. Gary Cooper and Audrey Hepburn in Alone in the Afternoon. But do you think that some of that has to do, look, if I'm thinking about Elvis Presley and Priscilla and Frank Sinatra and Natalie Wood or Mia Farrow or whoever, that those guys, they spent a lot of time with other guys as their friends. And I think they didn't want to be challenged by women their own age who would be their intellectual equal.
I think you're very, very right. I think that they were so accustomed to being king of the road that they didn't want to be in relationships where it posed any sort of threat to their superiority. This way, they could just be sort of the kingpin in the relationship. And, you know, these young girls didn't know any better, and they were also so thrilled and gaga to be involved with a star that they just kind of went along with it.
Priscilla Presley never was alone with Elvis except when they were in bed.
It was a very, very strange relationship. You know, my first book, I'm just thinking about this as we're talking about it. There's a pattern that's emerging, Gary, whether I realize it or not.
Good.
First book I wrote was, I also have a law degree, and I worked on the Howard Hughes estate case when I was really young. I started working on the case when I was 20 and started law school. And he's another one who had the famously aberrant relationship with starlets that he would put up in apartments, and he'd sometimes never even see them at all. He married an actress named Jean Peters. They moved into bungalows, separate bungalows, at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and they didn't even see each other, but I think twice in the entire years of their marriage. So
they're crazy?
Obviously... Yeah, there's obviously some kind of very strange power component to this.
Well, what do you think in Howard Hughes' case? I mean, that was the extreme, probably, because he had so much money, but also maybe he was mentally ill?
Yes, oh, definitely. But I think that, you know, you have to kind of wonder, and I think that in the case of Howard Hughes, I think it was progressive. I think that, you know, this is something that it's not as if he, in his 20s, exhibited all of these tendencies, but, you know, he had some tragic things happen to him. He was in a nearly fatal plane crash, and almost every bone in his body was broken, and he was put on all kinds of medications. So, you know, I think that's part of it. And I think that the other kind of villain in the story is probably fame. And the idea that when you're famous, you're in this cocoon, and you are really very often surrounded by sycophants who do your bidding and never question the morality or propriety of what you're doing. So I think that's a factor also.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Suzanne Finstad. She's the author of Natalie Wood, The Complete Biography. And we've sort of been talking about the Natalie Wood in the shadow of Me Too. And in her early films, when she was a little girl, especially Miracle on 34th Street, which is such a marvelous performance from her, she was kind of a, you know, she was a very intellectual little girl. I mean, that's what
she was. It's
kind of the charm of Miracle on 34th Street. But in kind of that middle period in the time that you were talking about her dating Frank Sinatra, she was often cast as kind of a victim, like in a movie like Cry in the Night or even The Searchers. Objectified, kind of.
Yeah, she was. I mean, Cry in the Night, if you watch that now, it's it just seems kind of almost shameless or shameful. And the kind of secret behind that, in another odd relationship, Raymond Burr, famous for Perry Mason, Raymond Burr was the thug in Cry in the Night who abducts young victim Natalie, who was just a teenager when she was in that film, as you said. And off-screen, Natalie is in a relationship with Raymond Burr, who not only is decades older than her, but who, and I'm not outing someone, it's very well known that Raymond Burr was homosexual and lived the last years of his life very happily in a relationship with a male partner. And in Natalie's case, they had a bona fide relationship. I don't know whether it was physical, but they talked about getting married. He was someone who was very worldly and sophisticated and was able to sort of school her in sophistication. She had already had a very violent incident with a famous film star who sexually assaulted her. And at that point, that's when she really began to be drawn to men who were either bisexual or who were not as sexually aggressive or sexually intimidating, because she was really traumatized by these things that had happened to her.
Did she not name this film star?
She did. And she named him to, I talked to five or six, I believe it was six different people who did not know of each other, did not know about, did not sort of confer with each other. So they were independent sources, including the high school friend that she went to the very next day after this happened, and have lots of intimate details that are in the book about what happened. And I had chosen not to name him because I felt that it would draw attention away from what happened to Natalie, if that makes any sense, and that the attention would be on this film star. And I didn't want people to question what occurred to her. I wanted them to focus on the trauma of what she experienced and not get into, she wasn't alive at that point to defend herself. And, you know, as happens with these famous men who are charged in situations like this, they either say it's consensual or they deny it, and she wasn't alive to defend herself. And I felt that under the circumstances, the most powerful way that I could convey that information as to what happened to Natalie was not to name him. So that's the reason. I absolutely know who it is. She said who it was. She was terrified of him for the rest of her life. She refused to do a film that he was in because he was in it, and it was starring an actor that she'd always wanted to work with. So this really imprinted her for the rest of her life.
Well, you can tell us, Suzanne.
At some point I will. I need to really, this is something that I've given so much thought, as I gave great thought to in the first edition in Natasha. I did not name the person that Robert Wagner was having an affair with in the first marriage, and I also really debated whether to reveal that it was a man, because, you know, I'm not in the business of outing people, and my job was to tell Natalie's story as effectively and truthfully as I could so that people could really understand what happened to her and how she reacted to it and what happened on that awful weekend. And I write about this in the new material, that when I was interviewing Robert Redford, who was a really close friend of Natalie's and just adored her, and he's obviously a famous director as well, and I asked him, I told him about the affair and how Natalie found out, and he was genuinely shocked. And I asked him whether I should reveal that it was a man, and he told me that I should consider how important that is to the story that I'm telling. And that was something that was absolutely essential. So by that yardstick, I did reveal that it was a man. And in the new material, I've actually, because I've gotten even more confirmation on the identity of this person, even his name, I named the man that she walked in on him having the affair with. So, you know, they're not things that I do or write about to be titillating or sensationalistic. It's, I really give tremendous thought to these things, and I realize that I'm writing about people, and that Robert Wagner's a person too. And, you know, you have to sort of consider all sides and be as fair as you can to everyone.
And I think you do that, clearly. I want to ask you about some of Natalie Wood's film roles before we talk about that last weekend of her life. There's so many roles of hers that I love. I loved Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, and I love...
I know, isn't that great?
And I think probably the role that most people have seen and continue to watch is West Side Story. And she's marvelous in West Side Story, but of course it's only kind of half of her. So I've always wondered, when she made West Side Story, did she think she would be doing her own singing in the picture?
Yes. This is actually one of the real sadnesses in Natalie's splendid career. She thought, she was told that she would be doing her own singing. And Natalie was such a pleaser and such a dutiful child, actress, and person that... She, of course, prepared meticulously. She got singing lessons. She gave it 100%. She sang all the songs, not realizing that never had they intended to have her voice be the voice that you hear in that film. Marnie Nixon is the one who did the singing. She did the singing for Julie Andrews, she did the singing for Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. And when Natalie found out, she was just devastated. And you know, that was a really difficult role for her, in that not only was she being asked to sing, and she wasn't a singer, thought she was being asked to sing, but she also was not a professional dancer, and she was not Hispanic, and she was playing a Puerto Rican. And she really does a creditable Spanish accent, and again, was very studious in the way she went about it. I'm not sure if her fans all know that, as you mentioned earlier, Natalie was really intelligent. She was really a smart cookie. When she was in her first film, though she's Russian-American, her parents both came to America from Russia and had to learn English, and Natalie spoke Russian growing up. Her real name is Natalia, and the nickname is Natasha, which is why I called the original book Natasha. And she was playing an Austrian girl in her first film, Tomorrow is Forever. And she managed to pull off an Austrian accent as a 5- and 6-year-old. And she was actually Russian-American and spoke primarily Russian and English, a bit of English, as much Russian as English. And she does it beautifully in blonde pigtails, to the point that Orson Welles, who was her co-star in that film, and who was a genius himself, called her a prodigy. So that's something that I don't think a lot of people know about Natalie. She wasn't just beautiful, but she was also a gifted actress, and she was gifted intellectually.
Suzanne Finstad, do you believe in supernatural stuff, personally?
I don't know if I would call... Well, I guess supernatural in the exact definition of supernatural, I guess that I do, in that I do think there are things that happen that are beyond the natural. I think that I had some of them happen when I was writing about Natalie. I think things that occurred in some kind of almost, it seemed almost mystical way, just coincidences that seemed to be so extraordinary, but how could they be merely coincidences? And I think that Natalie's life is the most profound example I can think of a life in which you see this thread of destiny, fate, mysticism, whatever you want to call it. She had this very superstitious Russian mother, and I expect this is where you're going with this, when the mother was a teenager, the family had fled Russia, and they were in Harbin, China, and she went to see a fortune teller in Harbin. And the fortune teller told her that she would have a second daughter who was going to be a famous beauty throughout the world. And she also told the mother that she needed to beware of dark water because she was going to drown. And she told this to Natalie from the time Natalie was born, and probably when she was still in the womb, knowing as much as I do about Maria. And Natalie so inculcated that she believed the prophecy was for her. And, you know, I don't know if it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's very strange. She was in so many scenarios on film where she was asked to do water scenes that ended up being dangerous or traumatizing for her. And she was her mother's second daughter, and of course she was a beauty famous throughout the world. Now her mother helped that prophecy along by, even when little Natasha was just learning to walk, they would be walking through the streets of Santa Rosa, California, where Natalie grew up, and the mother would secretly throw coins in front of her, and then she would say to Natasha, "Oh look, you know, here are coins. This is because you're a magical child. You're special magical child, and money just appears for you." And, you know, how could Natalie not believe in that sort of thing when, from the time she was little, that's all she was exposed to? So I guess to answer your original question, until proven otherwise, I think I kind of do believe in some supernatural things. I think that there's more to the world than what meets the eye.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Suzanne Finstad. She's the author of Natalie Wood, The Complete Biography. In the years since you wrote Natasha, Peter Bogdanovich made a film of which you were credited in the film, and Natasha was credited as being an influence in the film. And in that film, we see the death of Natalie Wood portrayed in this way. She is in her room, in her stateroom, and she hears an empty bottle rattling around in the dinghy, and so she goes to stop it and inadvertently falls into the water, and that is what causes her death. And Bogdanovich was here on From the Bookshelf, and he believes that that is what occurred, but you don't.
No, it's frankly, it's impossible. And I told Peter Bogdanovich that. There were sound tests that were done on the Splendor, the boat that Natalie was on. And from her stateroom, she could not have heard a banging, bumping dinghy, which was, you know, one of the theories proposed by Robert Wagner, that she heard this dinghy bumping and she got out of bed to try to retie the dinghy. Even if you believe that she heard it, it's so preposterous that she would try to do that herself. But in fact, from the sound tests that were done by a marine expert, you couldn't hear that from the stateroom. It was impossible. And you certainly wouldn't be able to hear a bottle that was rolling around in the bottom of the dinghy. There wasn't any bottle that was there to roll around in the dinghy that Natalie could have heard. And, you know, that was a really disappointing experience for me. It's a film that at the last moment, and I write about this actually in the new material, It's Not a Secret. It's one of the several ways, I think, that there have been attempts made by Robert Wagner to try to suppress the truth or the facts that I'm writing. And in the case of that film, just that was supposed to be adapted exclusively from Natasha, at the very last moment, as we had a script and we were preparing to film, the rights were assigned from the producer who purchased the rights to my book to someone else who was a friend of Robert Wagner's. And at that point, key scenes in the script were changed, and they were changed in ways that were not factual and that were antithetical to what I wrote about in Natasha. And I asked to have my name taken off the film because I told them from the outset that my role in this is to protect Natalie Wood and to do as much as I can to advocate for the truth to be told. And the changes that were made were very detrimental to Natalie. They made her appear responsible for the demise of her first marriage to Robert Wagner when that was not true. She did not have an affair that led to the end of that marriage. It was her husband, Robert Wagner, who had an affair that she discovered in that traumatizing way I mentioned earlier. And then the ultimate sort of diminishment is that they would, in the film, present Natalie as responsible for her own death by, you know, tipsily going out to try to get this bottle that it would be impossible for her to hear, rolling in the dinghy. And, you know, I just found it to be such, I don't know, it was disrespectful to me, disrespectful to her memory. And, you know, at that point, I was not able to remove my name completely, and I think they added some other, the name of a different writer so that I would not sue them over it. So, not to get into the nitty-gritty, but it was a really disappointing experience because that did not reflect what I wrote in Natasha, and it did not reflect what happened to Natalie, nor did it reflect what happened in her life, and they were things that were damaging to her memory. And that's where I parted company with the film group, and it's really a shame because, you know, there's an amazing movie or limited series to be made on the life and death of Natalie Wood, and it can only be made if it's done in a truthful way, because that's what's so powerful, and that's what needs to be told.
Well, as we've been talking, you know, it's a different era, so maybe this is the time to, to revisit it.
That's a really good point. It really is a different era, and people are more open to those truths now, so that's a great point, Gary.
Do you think there's any possibility that her death was accidental?
No, I don't. I don't. After spending decades of my life in the minutiae of what happened that weekend and having started this whole process when I began Natasha, believing that it was an accident, I had been a fan of Robert Wagner's. I still am a fan of his work. My older brothers watched It Takes a Thief, Heart to Heart. I watched it with them, thought he was charming, and when Natalie drowned and there were images of Robert Wagner with his peacoat pulled up over his back and his neck looking shocked and dazed, I wept for him and I wept for Natalie. I just thought it just was so tragic beyond tragic. So I went into the biography believing that it was a tragic accident, and I really had to be convinced in every way possible that it wasn't. And the facts are just, you can't ignore them. It's incontrovertible. And it now actually has been ruled to be not an accident. Her death certificate was changed, which is unprecedented. This was 30 years after a famous movie star died. To have her death certificate changed is extraordinary. And it was originally ruled an accidental drowning. and it was changed to drowning, not an accident, drowning and other undetermined factors. And more recently, in 2018, it's been pronounced a suspicious death, and Robert Wagner has been named the only person of interest. So those are huge, huge developments that have occurred since Natasha came out, and those to me are extremely redemptive, I guess. I'm pleased for Natalie because I'm so grateful for her that it's no longer believed that she was the cause of her own death, that she was drunk and fell over, that in fact this was, it was kind of a Hollywood murder mystery that it took me many years to resolve.
And I think what maybe the last third of your new book is devoted to that.
Yes. Yep, it is. And that, again, wasn't my intent when I wrote Natasha originally. Since I presumed it was an accident, obviously I was going to write about her death, but it was Natalie and her life that fascinated me. And only because I began to uncover all of these unsavory facts that the original police investigators never explored, ignored, willfully ignored, and closed the case within a couple of days, I felt this true sense of moral obligation to determine what happened and to reveal the truth and to, just so that there could be some sense of closure in the death of someone that was so beloved and was such an exceptional human being.
I alluded earlier to the fact that Frank Sinatra had something to do with this. So how did Frank Sinatra aid in the shutting down of the investigation?
Well, that's really interesting. One always sort of hears about what power Sinatra had, and you wonder how much of that is mythical, and in this case, it was very real. I interviewed Thomas Noguchi, who was the then L.A. coroner, and his lawyer, Godfrey Isaacs, and they both told me that Dr. Noguchi had announced, actually, in his initial press conference that he wanted to do what he called a psychological autopsy of Natalie Wood. He'd done something similar for Marilyn Monroe because he worked on the autopsy of Marilyn Monroe, and a psychological autopsy, in his view, was to question people who knew Natalie to try to understand what caused this to happen and why she would have either wanted to get off the boat, get into a dinghy. He knew that there had been some kind of friction or some sort of frisson between Christopher Walken, the other person who was on board the Splendor, the other actor who was Natalie's co-star at the time in Brainstorm, and Robert Wagner. And this came out at the initial press conference, and it's something that was caused a lot of gossip in Hollywood. At the time, all of the water coolers in Hollywood, the rumors were that Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken were having an affair. And Frank Sinatra was upset. He was a friend of Robert Wagner's, as well as a friend of Natalie's. And the coroner had also revealed, Dr. Noguchi, that Natalie was intoxicated, that they were all intoxicated. And Sinatra, in his avuncular way, did not appreciate having Natalie's drunkenness be revealed or have it revealed that the entire party had been drinking to the point of intoxication. And he wanted to shut this investigation down to protect Natalie's reputation in terms of the fact that she'd been drinking, but I think more to the point to shut down any investigation of whatever had been going on between Christopher Walken and Robert Wagner, because this came out during this press conference and it sort of started this firestorm of gossip, and that's something that Robert Wagner definitely wanted shut down. So Sinatra at that point intervened by calling the city office that is responsible for the coroner's office, and he threw his weight around. This is from Thomas Noguchi, who told me this, and his lawyer Godfrey Isaac, and they stated that Sinatra convinced them to shut down, well, actually convinced them to fire Noguchi. And by firing Noguchi, the psychological autopsy was shut down. And Noguchi's initial conclusion that this was an accidental drowning then stood. So I find it such a kind of bizarre irony that this person, Frank Sinatra, who genuinely loved Natalie and who believed that he was doing something to protect her, that by getting Noguchi fired and shutting down the psychological autopsy, he really foreclosed any true opportunity for an investigation to be done to find out what really did happen that weekend. Instead, everything was, people just walked away from it. The police followed suit, said it was an accidental drowning. They did no real investigation. Noguchi was fired. That was the end of the coroner's investigation. And that was the end of it. That was in 1981. And, you know, nothing had happened in the intervening years since I started Natasha, other than significantly the fourth person who was on the boat, who was a deckhand of the Wagners, who had initially given a statement that was supportive of what the 5 minutes of investigation that was done with Robert Wagner. His interview was only 5 minutes, which still just astonishes me, from the police. And the deckhand, as it turns out, did not even give a statement. He signed a statement, but it was prepared for him by Robert Wagner's lawyer. And in the years after Natalie drowned, he started to give a couple of interviews to tabloids. And because he was paid for at least one of them, it cast aspersions on his credibility, and because it was different than what his original statement said. So when I started the biography, that's what I was faced with, was what I thought was a bona fide investigation by the police and the coroner's office, and then what seemed to be sort of, tainted stories given by the deckhands to tabloids. And that's when I commenced my own investigation, which went on for years and years. And ultimately, I got access to what's called the murder book. It's not my term. It's what the homicide detectives in the L.A. Sheriff's Department call the homicide book of the investigators' notebooks and any notes that they may make of people who called in, whom they investigated, etc. And by getting access to that, which, by the way, now appears to be, I'm told, mysteriously missing, I was able to pursue leads that the original investigators never followed up on. So I basically just did all of that gumshoe work to put together a timeline for the original book, and then augmented by new witnesses that I have in the new book. And you can get almost a minute-by-minute account in my book of what happened on that last night.
Although, let's just let our listeners know that this book is primarily about the life of Natalie
Wood. Yes,
And she was a remarkable actress. I mean, there's not many actresses you can say appeared in dramas, comedies, musicals, westerns, social satire, science fiction. A wide-ranging career as an actress. She was a child, not a child star, but a child actress. And
yeah, there is a distinction. It's very astute of you to say that. And that's what saved her in a weird way, is that she wasn't a child star. She was a child actress.
And a great one. And and she lives on in the pages of this book, which is called Natalie Wood, The Complete Biography, and the author, my guest, Suzanne Finstad. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Book Show.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I can't tell you, this is one of the most enjoyable interviews I've ever done. I really appreciate your kind of wide-ranging questions and the depth of the questions and your understanding of Natalie and talking about it. It was really a pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.